Monday's about the last day.
So where do I find the article?
I was going to say, do you want me to bring down a hard copy or just email me right now?
We're going to call to order the meeting for the Senate Committee on Rural Communities and Economic Development. Today is April 4th, 2013. And we're pretty much going to go in this order. There may be a couple things that get moved around. We have at least one person in our Senate Bill 173 work group that has to be out by 3:45. So I do want to get the first one, Senate Bill 816, because we do have a representative here who's giving up of his valuable time, and I know how busy they are. So we're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 816. And we'll have a short explanation of the bill, and we'll bring, and if you want to bring anybody with you, you're certainly welcome.
Now, I'll stay here.
I think maybe I'll go first. Maybe the senator might.
Senator, Krasinski, you want to go out there? Do you want to
if you'd like, I'll stay here to make it quicker.
Okay, that's fine. So, okay. A short explanation.
Great. Senate Bill 816 establishes a fermentation sciences and value-added program at Oregon State University's Agricultural Experimentation Station. It would be operated in collaboration with community colleges and high schools in Oregon for the purposes of providing scientific research and market analysis to Oregon's wine, cheese, microbrew, distilled spirits, and artisan bread industries. The bill appropriates $2.5 million over 2 years and declares an emergency. It has no revenue impact and does not yet have a fiscal statement.
Representative Unger and Senator Krasinski.
Senator, you want to start us off and then I'll back you up?
I'm here for the whole time. We'll let the good representative go so he can get back to his other job.
Well, thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Unger, and I'm the state representative for House District 29, which serves the communities of Hillsborough, Cornelius, Forest Grove, Verbort, and Roy. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify and accommodating my schedule. I want to talk really briefly about Senate Bill 816 and how important I think it is to a whole variety of different economic interests and industries in this state. One of the things that I have been working on in my half of the chamber is helping to grow our agricultural economy. Agriculture and tourism are two of the largest industries, or actually the two largest industries in the state, and we're focused, at least in some of my committees, on trying to figure out how do we create more jobs in those industries. This will help. This research project, combined with a full funding of the statewides that we work through at Oregon State, gives us an opportunity to really invest in the research programs that we need in order to create the vibrant industries that are already starting to grow in here in Oregon. I have an interest in this project for two reasons. One, because I actually think funding for statewide programs overall is very important, and so one of the things I've been doing in the House especially has been putting helping to organize the House Agricultural Committee to make sure that we're putting our two cents in to say that we need to fund the OFC statewide at the full amount. So that's one of the things that I've been doing. And I think funding this bill and passing this bill along with it will give us an even more vibrant research program, especially for the things that we need for our agricultural economies. These industries, the cheese, wine, bread, beer industries, are industries that add value at a number of different levels in our economy, and by giving them more resources to expand their research, we can actually create the kind of jobs in rural areas that I think the state really needs. So I'll keep my comments short. I think this is a very important program. I appreciate Senator Krasinski for bringing this to our attention in the body, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Senator Krasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. I want to thank the chair for allowing us to have Senate Bill 816 before us, and I want to also recognize Representative Unger for all the work he's doing in the House. This is a very important bill for us to continue to foster what we've already have established in the state and the ag community as to how we can actually feature and grow our own and actually be very sustainable. We have the opportunity here to support many different types of industry and businesses that rely on fermentation. And as fun as we may have and the cheers we may give, the reality, it goes way beyond that. We heard from the committee administrator, when you're talking about breads, you're talking about cheeses, you're talking about a lot of different projects, even sauerkraut you can throw in there. So I think it's one of those things that we all should be proud of, our heritage and what we can do from what we can grow from the ground. And I'm very, very pleased that we have a number of individuals that are here today. I know Mr. Bonneau is here with Willamette Valley. Weinert, and also I know Ed King from King Estate has been very, very instrumental in helping foster our industries here. And with that, Mr. Chair, thank you again for allowing this bill to be brought forward.
Any questions for this panel? Again, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to keep it to a time, as you can see, there's a lot of people here, and there's a number of bills we have, so we're going to try to keep people down to around 3 minutes each, and we'll give you a warning up here when it gets close. So with that, Jim Bernot, Steve McCarthy, and Jeff Edgerton, if you want to come up front, that would be great. Go right ahead.
Chair, members, my name is Jim Bernot. I'm the president and founder of Willamette Valley Vineyards here on behalf of the Oregon wine industry. This measure is supported by the Oregon Wine Growers Association as well as King Estates and a number of other large producers. Oregon State University has already demonstrated excellence in innovation and research in our field. However, this is a much broader effort, and it has a much greater impact than the effort that we first began back in 1995 when the legislature supported, along with my own personal contribution, the formation of the Fermentation Science Program at Oregon State University. Now, I've got a handout for you. I know you often hear from groups to talk about, you know, how things will create jobs and how things will help economic development. But what I decided I thought I'd do today was to bring you a copy of my own financial statements. Our industry in large part is a creature of the public policy that this legislature has created since our industry was founded. Since that time, years ago when this legislature created the foundation for our industry, we now have over 450 wineries in Oregon, over 850 vineyards, producing over $2 billion worth of economic impact in our state. And yet we have a long list of identified research needs that will save millions or generate millions just for our industry. If you look at the financial statements, which I provided, the reason why I did this was because I wanted to make sure that you had in your hands absolute proof of what can happen when a winery starts and grows. This is just mine, and we only represent about 5% of the Oregon winery business. If you look through the years from 1995 through to the years 2011, you'll look to see the federal income taxes and the state income taxes that our business has created, as well as the employment numbers that our business has created. So if there's anything, I know that sometimes people make the argument that research produces jobs. What in your hands? You have the jobs that's been created and the tax revenue that's been generated just from our business. Another thing that this measure has in it is it encourages a level of synergy that is not done anywhere in the United States, or perhaps maybe not even in the world. Here's an example of it. We in fermentation and wine making, we have a variety of challenges to improve quality. One of the solutions we came up with was using an innovation that came out of cheesemaking. We are now using a yeast that cheesemakers identified. This strategy at OSU, this innovation at OSU, puts these fermentation sciences together so that we could benefit greatly by the opportunity of this measure.
Thank you very much.
My name is Jeff Edgerton. I'm the brewmaster for Bridgeport Brewing Company. I'm here today representing the brewers in Oregon. I'm very honored to be able to do that. Thank you very much for having me today. The Fermentation Science Program at Oregon State University for us is really it's an educational hotbed of people that are involved with brewing. Brewing science programs are very rare. There's a brewing science program in Chicago. There's a brewing science program in England. There's a brewing science program in Germany. There's one at University of California, Davis. There's over 5,650 people now employed in the state of Oregon in brewing. When we look for brewers, when we look for new people to come and brew for us, we're looking for educated people, the people that have a knowledge of the brewing process. It's a pretty esoteric industry. It's not something that's you can pick up by taking biology or chemistry or something like that. There's a lot of esoteric parts to this industry. Oregon State University provides that for us. We have multiple Oregon State University graduates that work for Bridgeport alone. We hire two interns every year. I know most of the other brewers in the state, the large brewers in the state at least, they have some kind of internship programs. They bring in people from Oregon State and allow them to work during the summer and get practical brewing experience. They do research for us. They do market research for us. They have a pilot brewery down there that they allow us. Bridgeport alone, as the size we are, we don't have a pilot brewery on. If we make a brew of beer, it costs us $4,000 or $5,000 to make a brew of beer. If we go down to Oregon State University, use their pilot brewing facility, pay them money, go down there, use that, we can make a brew for $500 that'll allow us to test our new products down there. So. It's a very invaluable service. The gentleman down there, Tom Shellhammer, Bob McGoran, Jeff Kloss, and all the people that run that program do a great job of addressing all the needs. They participate in an organization that we have called the Master Brewers Association of the Americas. The Northwest section is the largest section in the United States. There's over 250 members. They bring their students to the meetings, and they actually participate. They give presentations. And good presentations. They do a great deal of excellent research for us. So, in addition to the other, $2.44 billion that the brewing industry brings to the economy, they also bring this other aspect of having this educational aspect for us. So, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Senator, Chairman Roblin, members of the committee. Thanks for this opportunity to speak to you. My name is Steve McCarthy. I got the bright idea about 1980, having watched the wine people and the beer people completely rewrite the rule book for their industries, much of which happened here in Oregon. I got the idea of trying to do the same thing with spirits. And in 1909, my grandfather moved to the Hood River Valley, started a pear orchard. The family lost it all in the Great Depression. We bought it back after World War II. We had some years in the 70s in the Hood River Valley growing fruit where we couldn't get enough from the packing house to pay the pickers. And we could ride that out, but our neighbors cut down their trees with the fruit still on the tree. And I said, let's figure out how to do what the Swiss and the French and the Germans figured out about 300 years ago, which is to make very wonderful pure distillations of pure fermented fruit called eau de vie or schnapps and sell it to the Americans, which is what I've been doing ever since. This is one of my products. This is basically high-class legal pear moonshine. And it takes 30 pounds of Hood River Parkdale pears to make one bottle. And then in the value-added category, this pear is worth about 4 cents to the grower, FOB Farm Gate. This is an $80 bottle of pear brandy with the pear grown inside the bottle, and we can't make these fast enough. So we have 10 family wage career track people working at the distillery in Portland trying to do what these guys did, which is to change all the rules in the spirits industry. And we're making progress, not just here in Oregon, but it's popped up nationwide. We've hired, the last four hires at the distillery have been graduates of the food science program at Oregon State. We've hired a total of seven bachelor's degree graduates from that program, and they're just fantastic. They're eager. They know what work is all about. They come in prepared to set up a lab to keep records. I'll go out to the Oregon State graduates who are doing all the technical work and most of the distilling, and I'll say, what if we try to do this? And they'll say, well, here it is. We've already figured that out, and we're doing it. So it's a fantastic program, and one of the only ways that I could think of making it better, because it really is superb, one of the only ways I can think of making it better would be for them to have an actual still. We can use people that we then train ourselves, or we can use people that have already been trained in distilling, and there's some research projects we need help on. We can't do them. It's very much like the situation here with pilot brews. We have fermentations that stick at 30 seconds, at 6 or 8 bricks. We need to learn how to ferment the rest of that sugar to improve our output, and I'm aware of a still that is available for this program at basically no cost. So we're hoping that you can do this and we can begin to hire students who have actually been trained in distilling.
Thank you very much. Questions for this group? Yes. Senator Bagshugar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you happen to have some glasses?
Yes. Senator Close.
I have to ask about that pear. He said it was grown in the bottle. Is that a trade secret, or can you tell us?
This is something else the Swiss figured out about 300 years ago. Here's a picture from our orchard of me putting, of harvesting. We put the, in April, when the pears have set, we go up to the orchard with 5,000 of these bottles, and we put the branch inside the bottle with a pear, with a little bitty pear on it, and tie it on the tree. And then in August, and the pear doesn't know that it's in a bottle. It's just another day for a pear. We go in August when we harvest the major part of the pear crop, and we pick these as well. And then we bring them back. Bring them back to the distillery and clean them. It's a four-step cleaning process. It's all done by hand, and then we fill them with this same brandy. And as I said, this is an $80 item, and we sell all of them.
Thank you.
Other question?
To follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And so the alcohol preserves the pear. How long would it last?
Well, I have the first, we did it, the first one was done in 1988, and I still have it. And it looks about like this one.
Wow.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Thanks for being here. Next, we have Bill Boggs, Hayden Bush, and Roger Beyer.
Well, thank you, Senator Roblin and committee. I'm Bill Boggess. I'm the Executive Associate Dean at the College of Agricultural Sciences, and here to just provide a little bit of perspective on the Fermentation Sciences program. The individuals you just heard from have, you know, made the clear point about the importance of this industry, so I won't reiterate that. The last speaker, Mr. McCarthy, mentioned it's an 80-to-1 value added in his case, but just to give you some other numbers, in cheese, it's $2 to $10 worth of milk of cheese for every $1 in milk. In Pinot Noir, it's $4 to $8 worth of wine for every $1 of grapes. And in brews, microbrews, it's $20 to $30 of craft beer for every $1 of hops and malted barley that goes in it. So all of these commodities have very high value added to them. And also, as Jim and others made, the rapid growth and expansion of these industries has outstripped our capacity to support them with research and innovation. So let me turn my attention now to a little bit to the current program and what this package would make possible. Our current fermentation sciences program in many ways mirrors and supports Oregon's diverse industries. We're one of only two programs nationally that have enology, viticulture, brewing science, as well as the cheese and bread parts, so which, again, mirrors the Oregon industry. Second thing about our program and the Oregon industry is all of these products you were hearing about are premium products. They require premium inputs, and we have an integrated integrated supply chain focus, everything from soil to table. And so we have grapes and wine, we have hops and beer, we have milk and cheese, and this package would support both the input side as well as the fermented product side. So the new things that would be made possible within the package, one, as Mr. McCarthy mentioned, would be to add expertise in distilled spirits. We do have a still, but we don't have expertise in distillation. And the second addition would be on the business side, is the someone to do research on the branding and value-added product differentiation that's essential to maintaining the market aspects of this. So we have 30 seconds. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and the speakers made a good point of this, is the important workforce development pieces of this. And we have a student with us. And we also have some samples. We didn't bring Pear Brandy samples, but we brought samples of the artisan cheese that is a student-produced product from start to finish. And so I think there's...
Yeah, we already got it. We already got it. While you were talking, we got it.
So I'll turn it over to... You can actually hear from a student who has a real stake in this product. Thank you.
Right. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Hayden Bush. I'm not only a student in agricultural sciences at Oregon State, but I'm also a dairy farmer from Tillamook County. I'm here, obviously, to support Bill 816. About 70 years ago, my family moved from Northern California to Oregon because it was the promised land of dairy farming and of cheese making. My personal dream is to stay here in Oregon and work on either my family business or somehow give back to the industry that I've grown up in, which is dairy. At this point in time, I'm having to decide whether I need to bite the bullet on the family, and stay and work on the family farm, or basically follow a career path that could potentially lead to me moving out of state. I don't want that. I certainly don't want that. I love Oregon, and I hope that that the economy and fermentation science, and for me specifically in dairy, can get back to booming again. And personally, I think SB 816 really is a key to that. The innovative research that's going on at Oregon State is phenomenal. One of my mentors is Jeff Clausen, who is a brew house manager. So I can talk all day about dairy, but I can also delve a little bit into the brewery side of things. And I've had the opportunity not so much to work with him on what he's been doing, but more or less to hear about some of the things, and I'm just astounded. The research that's coming out of there is real, it's tangible, and it can be used in the real world. In addition to that, I ship my milk to the Tillamook County Creamery Association, and I know for a fact that several of the members on our staff are individuals who've graduated from the Food and Fermentation Science Department. So for me, I have a tie in that respect to the department and to the program that's going on. And I really feel that that this bill would really set the framework to capitalize on this economic opportunity for the future of beer, wines, cheese, and other products of the fermentation. And I also believe it would really provide an advantage to the educational opportunities to the students. I really believe in the importance of, for me, of course, the dairy industry in Oregon. But I also believe that these programs, these fermentation science products, are really one of the keys to our economy. And with that, I would like to say that I go on record as supporting 816, and that it would potentially stabilize these economies for the individuals involved in them. So for that, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I hope you enjoyed Oregon Dairy Day yesterday. You hopefully had a chance to sample some of the products that you've just heard about, and coming from the great creameries and cheese companies we have in the state. The Dairy Association is in support of Senate Bill 816 for all the reasons you just heard about. I'm not going to elaborate any further except for to say that the dairy industry has worked closely with OSU in the past with their dairy. We've had a rocky road in the very recent past. I think we're straightened out and we're back on track, and we're going down hand in hand still with the college, and we appreciate that opportunity and the college working with the farmers and the association. And so good bill, should pass, and if I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So any questions for this panel? No? Thank you very much. That was all the people who signed up for this bill. Is there anybody out there who wants to say a word or two? If not, we're going to have a couple comments from our committee. So Senator Pazansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would want to give somewhat of a potential possible conflict of interest here. Being from a land-grant school in Texas known as Texas A&M, I do have a soft spot for the land-grant schools. OSU is an excellent school. We have an opportunity to help their ag program through this process as a home brewer, understand how you can actually move forward. And it's really interesting from my perspective, where you have individuals who may be starting off as a hobby actually end up actually being a producer of jobs and economy here in the state. And there's actually a network within the brewing family, as I would call it, where even where one gentleman was tragically killed in an accident and his family set up a foundation, they now actually give two scholarships for under the Northwest Legends Foundation for brewing. And so then you have these young people who actually can take their hobby into a craft, into the industry, and we can see the results that we've seen in this state.
Yeah, and I my comment is that, you know, this really is one of those jobs bills all over the state, and it's in rural areas and in metropolitan areas. And, you know, you can go to Pacific City in my district, you can go to Tillamook, you can go to Portland. Anywhere you're going to find people doing these things. And in particular, the newest one has to do with spirits, because you've got Brookings and has their own distilleries now doing this. Really, we have one opening up in Coos Bay. It is an amazing thing that's happening in our state, and it can be done wherever you choose to do it, which is a really positive thing with respect to that. So we will be working this bill in the near future. We don't have all the paperwork back yet, but we will be doing that. And right now, we're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 816. And I thank everybody who came and participated, because it does really show the interest that exists amongst the people who have been successful in the business already, that they want to keep it and make it available for everybody else. So I thank you for that, too. With that, we're going to open a couple work sessions, and we have some testimony from people that we just want to hear where it's at. And I know, so Senate Bill 173, we're going to open a work session. Can I open both at the same time? Okay. And is Greg Wolf here? We'll have him come on up. So mostly this is just for an explanation if anybody has any questions. We've had the bill. We've seen it before. You might want to look it over real quickly, but if there's any questions for Greg, and Greg, if you have anything to say currently about the bill, it's mostly this is a bill that came out of our work last year about how we can help the distressed counties and give some authority to the governor and others to work to bring people together and get some things done. And we think they're really good bills. We haven't had a lot of testimony, but I think we feel pretty good about these. So. Any questions for Greg on 173?
Not from the
Okay, we might as well lend it. So we could get a motion? Or do you want to give an explanation of it first? You can give an explanation of the bill and we'll go.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 173 is the bill that we heard on March 21st. That creates a service delivery technical assistance program in the governor's office to assist counties in fiscal distress through grants for service delivery innovation, contracting for technical assistance, and convening task forces and work groups. And there is no revenue impact, and there is a minimal fiscal impact.
So with that, Senator Becker.
With that, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 173 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Bescher moves Senate Bill 173 to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred. We don't have it taken off. Right? To the committee, the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? Also seeing none. The bill passes, and we will close our work session on Senate Bill 173. That was going to Ways and Means, so we don't need to have a carrier. So now we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 251. And again, we'll give a short explanation, and then we can have some explanation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 251, we heard that bill on February 21st. And we have a proposed -2 amendment which replaces the measure. And the key components that are different from the original bill that we heard is that it, let me go back for a second, is that the original bill required the governor to convene a meeting with state and local permitting authorities and invite federal permitting authorities to establish a permit review plan and schedule when the land development proposal addresses significant regional priorities and requires at least two permits, one of which is state or local. And so the main difference between the Dash 2 amendment and the original bill is that it identifies the applicable permits. It also removes the requirement that the governor resolve issues and that the governor's decision is final for state permits. It also authorizes local government to request that the governor convene meetings, and it changes the reporting requirement to January 31st each odd-numbered year.
So what happened in the Dash 2s is we listened to a lot of different people and came back with all of their concerns addressed. So I'll let you make a few comments. Thank you.
Chair Roblin, that's correct. And we've also discussed this bill with the Ways and Means Subcommittee on
your
General,
name first.
Greg Wolf, Governor's Intergovernmental Regional Solutions Director. We've also discussed this bill with the Ways and Means Sub in General Government for the Governor's Office this morning, and believe that this will be a real assistance in terms of underlining the Governor's convening authority and creating a process there that will allow us to also not only convene state agencies but also federal agencies in looking at some of these permits.
So any questions for Greg? We don't have all the paperwork, so we're going to have to wait on this. We want to make sure you guys testimony before 3:45, and we made it, which was really quite nice.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we did talk about that we would put on the record that this, due to some concerns that were expressed, that this isn't meant to override any public processes that are in law.
So when you're putting these groups together, they're going to meet, but that, if it is expected that it's a public meeting, everybody, it's a public meeting, and we aren't changing any of that. We're just saying we may be able to streamline certain permits together and have the process work together, as opposed to having to do one process and then wait for the next process, and that's our hope for this whole bill. But public
process, meetings laws will still be in play.
Still works, yeah. So yeah, we aren't changing it. Oh, we just got all of our paperwork, so we're in good shape. So with that,
Mr. Chair, I'll note just for the record is we did get a fiscal impact statement, and that is in front of you, and it does require that we move the bill to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
And we got that merged, so we'll go through with
we're going to have to do the Dash 2.
Yes.
Dash 2.
Yep.
All right, Dash 2 amendments.
So, okay. Senator Boettcher.
Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-22-13 for Senate Bill 251.
Senator Boettcher moves adopt the Dash 2 amendments dated 3-22-13. Is there any discussion? Okay. Is there any objection? Seeing none. We have adopted the amendment. Senator Boettcher.
Chair Roblin, I move Senate Bill 251 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and add a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Senator Boettcher moves Senate Bill 251 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and add a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any opposition? I'll wait till this conversation happens. Are we okay? Okay.
Yes.
Okay. No objection. Senate Bill 251 has passed and has moved on to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. So we now will close the work session on Senate Bill 251. Thank you very much, Greg, for all the work you did, too. Should we go here or should we go to? We're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 605, and we'll have a short explanation of 605.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 605, we heard this bill on March 26th, and there is no revenue impact on the Dash 2 amendment, and there's a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash 2 amendment. The debt we talked about originally, I guess it was the original bill, or no, it was a Dash 1 amendment, and this, the change from the Dash 1 amendment to the Dash 2 amendment is that it adds a time limit of 155 days for the council to return a subsequent recommendation to the commission. So if you recall, this bill was the one that clarified that the Conservation and Development Commission must make findings on the territorial sea plan and then amendments to the territorial sea plan or ocean resources management plan recommended by the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. And so it requires the council to include commission revisions in subsequent recommendations and return it within 155 days.
But it also allows for that to be extended by either party if they need to be.
That's correct.
And this is when it's been worked and fine-tuned with a lot of different people. Is there any, I don't know that anybody has any questions about it. If they do, I'm just looking around. If not, then let's move forward. So, David Allen is a member of OPAC and also a member, a constituent in Newport. He's been involved and actively working with us. If you want to come up, Dave, if you have anything you want to state before we get going, we'd be glad to hear from you. It is a work session, so it's just not generally that we have hearings, but.
Chair Roblin and committee members, thank you for inviting me here today. I drove here from Newport today. It was a nice drive, so it was enjoyable scenery. The reason I'm here today is I was asked by the chair.
Oh, you need to give your name first, today.
David Allen.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And I'm a resident of Newport, and just want to thank everyone for inviting me here today. The reason I'm here is to give some background on this bill. There's been a lot of work put into it, and there's a lot of history behind this bill, and I think Chair Roblin wanted me to be here to discuss that background and answer any questions you might have, since it really is an important bill, even though there's not many changes to the language. So I'll just briefly go through what the issues are. I'm a member of OPAC. That's the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. I'm the Coastal Public At-Large member. I've served on OPAC for the past 8 years. I've also chaired the Territorial Sea Plan Working Group, which was the primary working group in moving forward some of the amendments to the Territorial Sea Plan, which became somewhat of an issue earlier this year. In light of that, in January, when there was some amendments made to the Territorial Sea Plan, what I'm going to refer to as Part 5, that has to do with renewable energy siting in the Territorial Sea, some procedural issues came up as far as how some of those decisions were handled at the Land Conservation Development Commission level. Just briefly, the history of the Territorial Sea Plan and OPAC's role in that is that OPAC has been a primary advisor to LCDC under state law for the past 20 years, ever since the Ocean Resources Management Act was put into law. And as the Territorial Sea Plan was created and amended, OPAC's recommendation was always the primary recommendation that was looked upon. There was some deviation from that in January, and some concerns were raised because of that. OPAC's recommendation wasn't necessarily the primary one that was looked at initially, and some folks brought some concerns to the coastal legislators, and to their credit, and I'd like to thank the Coastal Caucus for listening to those concerns, and in working with me and a few other folks, putting together this language that's now before you. So what we believe is this language has three components to it. If you look at the Dash 2 amendments, there's a few changes. The first change is adding some language, and I'm referring that to line 9. That's adding the language recommended by the council. That's just really, in my view, this is only my personal opinion. I'm not speaking on behalf of OPAC. I'm here in my individual capacity only. But I think that makes explicit what's already implicit in the statute and the legislative intent, which is OPAC's recommendation is the one that LCDC needs to look to in making its decision. So that just explicitly states what many of us believe was already written into the law, although not as expressed as it is now. The second change is one that goes into if LCDC sends the issue back to OPAC with certain specified revisions, OPAC is to include LCDC's revisions in OPAC's recommendation. We think that's just an acknowledgement of really also with what's already going on, which is OPAC only advises, LCDC makes the decisions. So that's just an acknowledgement that OPAC will include LCDC's revisions as part of its advisory role. So that's really already just implicit, but we're making it more explicit. And the final change is really the additional language that I kind of am looking at, which is the timeline. I think to move this bill forward, it was my understanding that some timeline was required or asked for. 155 days came up with an escape clause as mutually agreed to extend. I'll kind of leave it to the folks that came up with that timeline. I'm not going to really speak to that other than to say that OPAC has been very diligent in the work it's undertaken over the past 8 years. There's never been an issue with OPAC getting its work done. So I think this timeline, although I don't think it's necessary, if it's needed to move the bill forward, it seems to be fairly straightforward and understandable. So I'll just kind of leave it at that as far as that issue goes. But the first two issues that I spoke to were really the primary ones that I think many of us felt needed to be addressed.
And, you know, from the Coastal Caucus perspective, it was a deal of the respect owed each group in making this process work. And we felt pretty good about coming up with a solution that we could work on. I appreciate your work with that as well, David. So with that, thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
So with that, I think we're ready to move this bill.
Are we ready, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay. Chair Roblin, I move to adopt the -2 amendments for Senate Bill 605, dated 3/28/13.
Senator Bearsugar moves to adopt the -2 amendments, dated 3/28/13. Is there any objection? Seeing none, is there... So moved. The amendments are adopted. I was also looking. We have to rescind the referral, so
right.
That's coming up too.
That's the next.
I was reading
the
at the same time. Compound,
so. Dangerous.
It is dangerous.
Chair Roblin.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Okay. Senator Bearsugar moves Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? We changed this bill enough that it didn't have any cost, so that's why it doesn't have to go to Ways and Means for people who aren't.
Just ink.
Yeah, just ink. That's right. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none. So ordered. I'd like to carry this one, if that's okay. So, thank you very much. And we will close our work session on Senate Bill 605.
Do you want to keep yours for the last, or do you want to do...
How long do you think that...
606 might be short. I don't know.
I think Geisinger needs to get out of here.
Okay, well, what do you next? We're going to open a public hearing on SJM... And with that, we'll have our own Senator Herman Bearsugar go up to the dais, and he can bring with him Mr. Jim Geisinger. Sorry if I broke up your other group, Jim, but Herman wanted you here. So. And with that, we'll have a short explanation.
Great. Chair Roblin, committee members, Senate Joint Memorial 10 urges Congress to establish a board of trustees to manage 2.7 million acres of Oregon and California Railroad grant lands. It proposes that the board manage 1.1 million acres for natural succession and recreation and 1.6 million acres for sustainable forest commodity production at 500 million board feet or more. Urges authorization for the board to negotiate land exchanges. The -2 amendment clarifies that the ONC grant lands are intended to be used for sustained timber production and county stability, and clarifies that the ONC Act of 1937 applies specifically to the 18 counties containing grant lands. There is no revenue impact, and a statement has not been issued for the fiscal.
And before they get started, I just want to say to our committee, we have heard two previous hearings about the ONC lands. One had to do with a joint memorial, I think it was six, that had to do with one of the proposals. We then heard from the governor's office with regard to his work that was done during the interim to try to bring a whole lot of groups of people together and work on it. And then this is the third time, because I will tell you that from, I think, everybody's perspective in Oregon, O&C is very important. And so we're trying to get as many ideas and thoughts out there and so people can have conversations about how we can help. It's really going to be, as it's indicated here, a federal decision. And our hope is that the federal government is paying attention and listening to different ideas that we've had proposed so far. So with that, Senator Bertscher.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you. My name's Herman Bertscher, Senator, District 2. I think I'll first start out just doing a real quick recap on O&C lands. The lands were originally granted to the Oregon-California Railroad Company by the federal government in the 1860s to encourage development in western Oregon. When the railroads failed to meet its obligations to sell the land to settlers, the government took back the land in 1916. The 1937 legislation was passed by Congress to compensate counties for being deprived of property tax revenues and privately owned land base for economic development. According to Section 1181A of the O&C Act, O&C timberlands are to be managed for permanent forest production, with timber to be sold, cut, and removed in conformity with the principle of sustained yield for the purpose of providing a permanent source of timber supply, protecting watersheds, regulating stream flow, and contributing to the economic stability of local communities and industries, and providing for recreational facilities. So as the country was settled, Congress would give lands to railroads, and what the railroads would do to those lands is they would sell them and then basically pay for the expansion of the railroad. And it worked pretty good. It worked pretty good all across the prairies until we got to Oregon and ran into a few mountains, and it didn't work so good. And so that's why you have this checkerboard pattern, because all across the western states, the government would give every other section to the railroad with a certain distance from where the proposed railroad would be. This is not the first time the Oregon Senate had to go and ask Congress to intervene with the O&C lands. I'd like to read Chair Roblin, a little bit out of the Journal of the Senate, February 14, 1907, to His Excellency, they used a little different terminology back then, to His Excellency the President and Honorable State and House Representatives of the United States of America, your memorialist, the Legislative Assembly of the State of Oregon, most respectfully represents that vast tracts of public lands within Oregon are claimed and held by the Oregon-California Railroad Company. As guarantee of this succession, under the Acts of Congress of the United States of July 25, 1866 and April 10, 1869, that said tracts are withdrawn from sale, whereby the development and material prosperity of the state is retarded. That said railroad company so claiming said lands has not complied with the terms of said act of April 10, 1869 as to the terms of sale and the quantities of land to be sold. That said conditions are claimed to injure only to the United States as grantor to the predecessor in alleged interest of said California Oregon Railroad Company and have not been complied with. Well, that's kind of what has happened with the 1937 O&C Act today. It basically has not been complied with. So the Senate has, this is another go-around for the Oregon Senate, to send a message to our federal government that the 1937 Act has not been complied with and we need to fix it. So in the proposed bill before you, Senate Joint Memorial 10, what it basically asks our federal government, and we have to remember, this is a concept, a very general concept, but what it basically does is it designates the 2.7 million acres of the O&C lands and puts it in a trust. And this trust, that is the objective. The goals of the trust are to move in almost two different directions, but very parallel. So all the title of the lands and the subsurface minerals will still remain with the federal government. Management of the surface resources will be transferred to this ONC Trust Board. The board authorized by this trust will authorize the governor to appoint 9 members to the ONC Board of Trustees, including 3 representatives of each of the following. 3 from government, including 1 member who represents one of the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. 3 from environmental organizations, and 3 from the timber industry. When we crafted this proposal, one thing that I really felt was most important is to give flexibility to this trust to manage these lands and not to try to manage the lands from a capital somewhere, whether it's the Washington, D.C. or Salem, Oregon, either one, but try to give flexibility. Try to give them a direction, some goals, but yet flexibility, because forests are so dynamic, so changing, that you have to have that flexibility. So in that flexibility, we place about approximately 1.1 million acres of the ONC trust lands in a reserve to be managed by the Board of Trustees for natural succession. So it's basically no commercial activities. Then designate about 1.6 million acres to be managed by the Board of Trustees for timber production on a sustainable yield. Now, I would like to draw your attention back to that February 14th, 1907. That's a long time ago, Even back then, the Oregon Senate talked about having the lands managed for sustainable yield, sustainable production. So that hasn't changed much coming out of Salem. Also, this would also recognize the tribes of Oregon as a stakeholder in this process. It also authorized the Land Exchange Authority, as we know, that the lands are in a checkerboard of sections, which is 1 mile by 1 mile. This would give the ability of the trust to start blocking up lands to make the management of the 2.7 million acres a lot easier to do. The checkerboard is very difficult to manage and very inefficient, so it'll also give those that ability. But again, I'd like to go back and clarify that the objective is to get the management of these lands back into the state of Oregon and to manage them with the two goals. Some of the lands will be managed for natural succession, and some of the management will go to timber production. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Yep. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Geisinger. I represent Associated Oregon Loggers here in Salem. We're an association that represents 983 small family-owned businesses involved in the logging industry. I'd like to start by thanking you, Chair Roblin, for having the hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 10, and certainly thank Senator Bert Sugar for all the hard work that he's put into this memorial, and certainly for recruiting a very impressive bipartisan slate of co-sponsors for this memorial as well. I think everyone's aware that several members of the Oregon Congressional Delegation has been working on this issue for the past 18 months. They've actually developed a bill, those members being Congressman Walden Schrader and DeFazio. Their legislation isn't identical to this memorial, but is very, very similar. It's very similar conceptually in that it does turn the management of the ONC lands over to a trust. Just yesterday morning, I was in a meeting with one of the co-sponsors of that legislation, Congressman Schrader. He made reference to this joint memorial. He made reference to the senator from Southern Oregon, whose last name he couldn't pronounce, but I'm almost certain he was referring to you, Senator Bertrager. And he was referring to joint memorial number 10. He said it would be immensely helpful to them to have an expression of support from the state legislature to advance their legislative efforts on solving this problem.
I'd like to just make a couple comments about the ONC lands. They've been managed for the last 60 years, producing at one point over a billion board feet per year. And today there's more standing saw timber inventory on those lands than when they started. Sustainability has been proven on these lands. And the counties have benefited tremendously over the years. That revenue stream has been deprived for the last couple of decades. It needs to be restored. But more importantly, the industry that many of these communities depend on needs to be supported as well. As important as these ONC revenues are to the counties, if they lose their basic manufacturing infrastructure, which they have lost a lot of in the last two decades, these payments don't amount to much. So they have to be working in tandem to get the timber revenue shared, but also to support local industry. The 500 million board feet that's mentioned in this joint memorial comes right from the ONC Act. It's in the statute that these lands should produce no less than 500 million board feet per year. So it's consistent in that respect. So I would encourage this committee to pass this memorial and to continue building the coalition, a bipartisan coalition within the building here, to get this passed. I think it would be helpful to our congressional delegation. These lands are unique to Oregon. We're in a very good position to move legislation this year. Congressman Schrader and DeFazio are both key members of the House Agriculture and Natural Resources Committees, respectively. We now have a senator chairing the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee. There's no reason, with the legislature's support, that our delegation shouldn't be able to pass this legislation in 2013. So I would ask for your support, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for this? Okay, thank you both. We're going to try to go back to our 3 minute now. We generally let the sponsor have as much time as they need, but Pete Shepard, Bill Kluding, and Ralph, come on up. Oh, it was that Ralph. Yeah. Yes. No problem. Yeah. Groner kind of dribbled his last name, so we.
Yeah. He does that.
He does that, yeah, I know. And you can start any way you go.
In a little bit.
But 3 minutes, so.
Total for all three?
Yeah. No. We'll give you each three. Whoever wants to start.
Mr. Chair, Ralph Groner, Oregon, asked me. We already submitted an article that we submitted throughout Oregon in behalf of our congressional delegation. We are a public employee and private employee union of 25-26 style. We wholeheartedly support this, primarily to look at our counties, Coos, Lane, Josephine, Clackamas, Hood River, Lynn we don't have, but we have Albany. Jackson we don't have, but we have Medford. Lincoln County, et cetera. Our members and the people who live in these counties are suffering. The people who live in these counties, just a lady told me today, I moved here because she felt in Josephine County she didn't have the safety of police, and she said it's increasing, more and more people are saying bye-bye. Bottom line for my union, along with Timber, is this is a fair proposal in our opinion. Ken Allen has sent not only are we lobbying here, but helping to our international union on this issue. I would hope that you can find in your heart, and thank you for all the work you've done on this, to help us help those people, not just our members, who live in these communities, get back to work and help bring in some jobs and some income tax to help from those jobs fix this state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair, Committee for the Record, Bill Kluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Briefly, thank you for your work. My organization endorses this Senate Joint Memorial 10 completely and urges quick passage. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pete Shepard, I represent the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Sausa Indians. And in analyzing Senate Joint Memorial 10, we've asked ourselves basically three questions. The first one is, what is the effect of a joint memorial? And it turns out you can answer that question by looking at the form and style manual of the Office of Legislative Counsel. And one of the key things for me there is it specifies that a joint memorial is not law. So you're not engaged in a lawmaking function here, and that makes a difference in the way we thought through the analysis of the issues. The second thing is, if it's not law, what is it that you're doing? And the manual says, well, it's the mechanism used to address or petition Congress. So in layperson's terms, it's a sophisticated form of cheerleading. And so the second question we asked about analyzing this memorial is, does the cheer exhort the team to do something objectionable to the tribe? And the answer is, as introduced, it does. Okay. Because as introduced, the printed measure does not address the question of the tribe's interests in these lands, and I would incorporate by reference the testimony I gave you on Senate Joint Memorial 6. And so without first addressing tribal concerns or simultaneously addressing the tribal concerns, we don't think there can be a fair or complete answer to this very difficult problem of the ONC lands. That's why we've sought amendments. I understand they're not here, but they perhaps will arrive later, and those would be welcome. And I want to publicly thank the chair and your staff for your courtesy in helping to develop those, and particularly Senator Birchiger, for your assistance. You gave very generously of your time and your counsel, and I appreciate that greatly. I also want to applaud Senator Farioli and his staff for using their good offices from his perspective as a longtime co-chair of the Legislative Commission on Indian Services. And finally, Mr. McVeigh and Mr. Barrows of the ONC County Association, very courteous and very professional in their working with us. So the third question, does the cheer generally exhort the team to move the ball in the correct direction? And the reason that I put it that way is that to really kind of strain the cheerleading metaphor, when the duck cheerleaders cheer for the ducks, they don't cheer for a particular play, they just cheer for them to score. And so we look at this joint memorial and we ask ourselves the question, in terms of the underlying principles of the memorial, are there things that we can support? And there are two that I think are key that we can get behind. The first is that our members experience the consequences of diminished or threatened diminution of these resources in the same way that non-tribal members suffer them. We talked about that some in connection with Senate Joint Memorial 6. And we agree that to the extent that this memorial urges Congress to advance the ball down the field on this issue, that our members share that interest, and we want to help do that if we can find a way to do that. And second, Senate Joint Memorial 10 urges Congress in addressing that need to place local or state government in a position in managing those federal lands that still will remain titled to the United States, but that it's thought, and the underlying premise, I think, of this memorial is that placing it at that local level of control will aid in unlocking some of the untapped potential of these lands. And that's precisely what our proposal for restoration of 14,500 acres of land would do for us. It would place in the control of the tribal government, a quintessentially local government, the primary responsibility for managing these lands, still pursuant to federal environmental protection statutes and other kinds of checks and balances. So likewise, we can support Senate Joint Memorial in that aspect of its exhortation to Congress.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this group? No. Thank you all for being here. Next, we have Greg Block and Rob Kalvanis.
Chair, did you pass 816 experience? Did you
know? No, it was just public hearing. We didn't have all the paperwork. We need to. We're good. Yeah.
Thank you for being here, and whoever wants to start.
Thanks.
Chair Roblin, committee members, my name is Greg Block. I'm a vice president with the Wild Salmon Center, headquartered here in Oregon. We work closely with a number of other groups. I won't name some here, some not, but we thank you for convening us on this important ONC lands issue, and more generally for your energy trying to address the county funding crisis. Your work there is very important. I was fortunate, I believe, to participate on Governor Kitzhoffer's ONC lands panel. And I think we shared some really valuable perspectives with colleagues from timber and from the counties. We all benefited from that. We have a much deeper understanding of the really complex trade-offs that are implicit in some of these land management proposals. And I'm happy to share a little of our thinking on that today. I'm going to focus my comments on two particular aspects that deal with water issues, which is more central to our mission, and I know some other organizations are focused more on terrestrial or land issues. But I do want to say we have gained a great deal from that process and appreciate any opportunity for more detailed briefings and sharing what I think we've all learned. We'll be submitting as well more detailed written comments that'll be forthcoming, and I won't be as quite as limited to the issues I'll address in my remaining time. These ONC lands really didn't have a separate identity for many of us, including myself. And the first thing we tried to do as a science-based organization is understand the full array of values, both economic, including timber, and conservation. We partnered with the Nature Conservancy and access to a lot of interesting databases, display this information. We'd love to make this available to you. It's available online as a resource. If we have a good year of fundraising, I'd be happy to provide copies. But right now, we're down to our last few. But most of my factual assertions are grounded in these databases. Again, they look at a full array of conservation values, especially recreation values that till recently hadn't been quantified, of some staggering numbers for jobs and revenue that are important to the state. And we do support timber harvest at sustainable levels as an important part of this picture, but not the only part. We'd like that context to be remembered in my remarks. So basically, the two issues I wanted to focus on regarding water, one, of course, is drinking water. The ONC lands provide roughly 1.8 million Oregonians with their drinking water supply that actually at some point spent a large point of their life cycle, water cycles, on the ONC lands. This is really important because it avoids tens of millions of dollars of costs in potential secondary treatment costs if these waters are impaired. A recent example that most of us remember from Bull Run, that over $60 million in secondary treatment costs were avoided because the watershed was well-functioning and clean. I'm going to accelerate my time. I see some red. But it's really important to remember that there are economic costs that the ecological services provided by healthy watersheds save us money, too. They're really natural refrigeration and filtration systems. Why is that so important? Well, it's important to my second reason as well, salmon. I won't go into great detail on this, but we can be really proud in Oregon that some of the healthiest salmon runs south of Canada are in these western Oregon coastal watersheds. They've been ranked by experts recently, 50 populations. We always hear about the depleted populations. 50 healthy populations, independent healthy populations, and iconic rivers like the Rogue, Umpqua, and Mackenzie. They're healthy, and I'll get to my recommendations briefly.
Because we've already gone over the 3 minutes, and we will look at your reading, too. So
appreciate that. They're healthy because of a major anchor called the Aquatic Conservation Strategy, which is part of the Northwest Forest Plan. It provides generous stream buffers and scientifically validated river protections. These are roughly eight times the protections that rivers enjoy on federal lands, on private lands downstream. So our recommendations tie directly to those two things, preserving the Aquatic Conservation Strategy, a plank in the Northwest Forest Plan, and the possible adverse impact from a couple of the provisions that we propose amended language to in the memorial. The current language that we have specific issues on that we're concerned have adverse impacts on these water values are the 500 million board feet target that's stated and the specific acreage delineated in the trust. And I could go into reasons for that, Senator, but I won't to save time. We do think that it would be much more helpful to replace that language by crafting principles that help guide the federal decision makers and others, similar to those that have been offered by Senator Wyden and Governor Kitzhaber, central features of which that we strongly support include increasing timber revenues and harvest, but retaining the core elements of the Northwest Forest Plan, including the Aquatic Conservation Strategy, protecting special places, and complying with federal law. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Robert Clavins. I'm the Wildlands and Wildlife Advocate for Oregon Wild, and I should flag, this is a little bit out of my usual wheelhouse, so I'll defer some specific, if any specific questions to either Greg or can certainly bring them back to the organization. On behalf of our 12,000 members and supporters, I want to thank the members of this committee for your work to find a solution to the budget shortfalls that are facing some Oregon counties. This memorial and other proposals to remove public lands in Western Oregon from federal orders, oversight in order to aggressively expand logging have some enormous implications for Oregon's clean drinking water, salmon, tourism, and recreation and economy. The actions called for by this measure would also have serious unintended consequences in regard to new restrictions on state and private land management in Oregon and for Oregon's state budget. Oregon Wild believes there are a number of very serious problems with this joint memorial, and as it is currently drafted, we have to strongly oppose it. First, the logging-heavy approach of this memorial undercuts efforts by U.S. Senator Ron Wyden to craft a long-term solution to the expiration of the vital Secure Rural Schools program. The contents of this joint memorial are strongly at odds with Senator Wyden's outline for a balanced approach to the problem and would serve to undercut his efforts in the U.S. Senate. The memorial fails to consider the findings of Governor Kitzhaber's recent panel on county payments and ONC land management, which found that there was no way to generate the revenue needed without violating environmental protections like the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. Additionally, the memorial fails to recognize the inherent conflict between aggressively expanded logging, including clear-cutting on America's public lands in Western Oregon, and the inevitable negative consequences to salmon, clean water, and Oregon's tourism and recreation industries. It does not voice support for protecting these values, which are all vital to the long-term economic and environmental health of our state. Finally, this memorial could have some serious unintended consequences. The actions called for under the measure would dramatically weaken the Northwest Forest Plan in Oregon. Though it is unpopular with some in the logging industry, the plan has provided regulatory certainty for private timberland owners in Oregon. Because federal lands are managed under strong conservation standards, state and private landowners have been subject to more relaxed federal standards than they otherwise would. Were the actions called for by this memorial to take place, they would spark a new round of litigation and conflict over forestry, likely resulting in new restrictions on state and private lands logging. For these and other reasons, Oregon Wild would strongly urge the members of this committee to vote no on this memorial as it is currently written. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you both.
Thank you.
And the last person that signed up is Christina McNitt. Bring it, yeah.
Thank you, Chair Roblin and members. For the record, I'm Christina McNitt with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. OFIC is a trade association that represents large industrial forest landowners and timber products manufacturing firms. Some of our members are vertically integrated, and some just own timberlands, and some are purely manufacturers. So on the face of it, you might think that those entities have diverse and disconnected interests on this matter. But I'm here to tell you that that's not so. And in fact, there's a growing consensus that the value proposition of owning forest land and keeping forest land in a forest land base really vests in the infrastructure of a local community to process that resource. And this infrastructure and those communities both need timber supply. Today, the federal government owns 60% of all of Oregon's forests and produce 15% of its harvests, whereas by contrast, private landowners, the large ones, own 19% of the forest land base and sustainably produce 67% of the harvest, and they've done so for decades. OFIC supports Senate Joint Memorial 10 and really encourages this body to ask Congress to change the paradigm of management on ONC lands, 2.7 million acres of land within 18 of our 36 counties. We have to be able to do something from an Oregon way, an Oregon perspective. That's what we're known for. We've done it before, and we can do it again. I'm really privileged today to be here with one of our members, Dave Ivanoff. Dave is the Vice President of Resources at Hampton Affiliates. It's headquartered in Portland, but he operates locally, and there's nobody who can share the story better about the impact and importance of public timber supply to a local community and mill. Dave?
Thank you, Chair Roblin and Vice Chair Bertschager.
I'm Dave Ivanoff, Vice President of Resources for Hampton Lumber. We're a family-owned forest products company with 550 direct employees working at our Willamina, Tillamook, and Warrenton sawmills. Like all the rest of the family-owned forest sector businesses that are still operating in this state, our company is incredibly dependent upon public timber, and the lack of affordable and adequate availability of raw material is our biggest single issue facing our sector. I want to thank you for addressing the issue of the non-management of our federal lands, and in particular the ONC lands. The lack of management on that landscape is imperiling forest health and destroying the social fabric of rural timber-dependent communities. I'm convinced that passage of this memorial could lead to congressional action, which would produce higher sustainable timber outputs necessary to restore forest health and improve the economic viability of our rural communities. Without improved outputs from federal lands, we're going to continue to lose that landscape to catastrophic fire as we go down the path of losing more infrastructure because of inadequate raw material. We're going to see private forest lands converted to non-forest uses, which is not good for the environment, and we're going to continue to see the decline of the ONC counties. A number of years ago, I served as chair of the Oregon Forest Industries Council, and during my time as chair and while I served on that board, we conducted public opinion polls on a regular basis to test the public support of forest management. And when the public understands under the strict environmental protection laws we have in this state that we can provide clean water, abundant fish and wildlife habitat, and simultaneously improve sustainable timber output levels to support schools and local government needs, the public is overwhelmingly behind that. In conclusion, I've been involved in forestry for 40 years in the state of Oregon. I'm incredibly proud of the ability of our state to grow and sustainably harvest timber. And certainly in my position supplying raw material for our sawmills, I have an incredible personal interest in this. But I also have an even deeper personal interest, as my daughter is a prosecuting attorney in the Lane County DA's office, and she has told me horror stories of prosecuting very violent people and then having those same individuals, after they're tried and convicted, back out on the streets because we don't have the revenue to support the public safety that we need in this state. And I guess I would, the last thing I would say is I would respectfully request that this committee support passage of this measure and emphasize the extreme sense of urgency to Congress to take action, because retention of the status quo is going to continue to drive our state further and further into the hole. And if we have this abundance of natural resource wealth available to us, and why we choose not to manage it in a sustainable manner to improve the social fabric of our state is really hard to understand. And I profoundly thank you for your interest in taking this issue up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? Thanks again. And that concludes all of the people on that bill, and we will... We're waiting for amendments. We'll talk about this as time goes on, and I want to close our public hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 10. With that, we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 6.
Yes. No, I haven't read it yet.
Oh, 06. And with that, we'll have a short explanation of 606 by our administrator.
It's a nice stack with about three other books. Yeah. Myself not having time to make for pleasure.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 606 requires an owner or operator of a wave energy facility or device to remove all related equipment within 6 months of cessation of use. It requires the Department of State lands to remove equipment within 1 year if the owner or operator fails to comply. And it authorizes the department to seek financial remedies for violation, including drawing upon the owner or operator's financial assurance, taking civil action for damages, or assessing civil penalties. It also directs the department to compensate holders of commercial fishing licenses for damages from loss of fishing grounds due to failure to remove wave energy equipment. And finally, it establishes the Wave Energy Fund for contributions and penalties to pay for program administration and commercial fishing mitigation.
So we want to get this started, and there are some amendments that are coming that aren't here. We have the dash ones out, but I think we have some more amendments that are coming. So do we have a list of who want to talk? This has been an ongoing work in the Coastal Caucus, along with a number of other people. And so Terry Thompson, Jason Bush, and Fred Vanetti might have all of them come on up. The issue has been, if many of you, and Terry might even explain this a little more, we did have a buoy end up sinking off the Oregon coast off of Newport and eventually recovered. It cost about $1 million, I think, to get it off the ocean floor. And we, as we start looking at this new opportunity that may exist in the ocean for ocean energy, we want to make sure that we put in place the things that were important to make sure that those things can be removed and other things take place. So with that, we'll let Terry start.
Thank you. My name is Terry Thompson, and I'm county commissioner with Lincoln County, but I'm also a commercial fisherman and active participant in all kinds of ocean research.
And a past representative.
Yeah, past House member of the House of Representatives. Term limited out. glad to see that gone. Here's the problem. I put a bill in which required bonding, I think it was 4 or 6 years ago, for wave energy devices. When it went to rulemaking, they basically opened the door too wide. There we had the Fenavera buoy, which Fenavera went and dipped into their own pockets beyond any requirements that were there to remove the device. And I don't know exactly what the price was, but I'd say it exceeded $1 million, okay, maybe more. Today, Ocean Power Technology has put an anchor in the bottom off of Florence, and I'm not sure that the state has the adequate funding to remove that device, and I'm not sure what the future will be there. And so it brings to light why this bill. And working with Jason Bush and other members of the industry, I think we all agree that we want to see the devices successful if they can be. If they're not successful or they become obsolete, we need adequate language to make sure that somebody cleans it up, whether it's the companies, the state, that there's funding there, so that it doesn't become a permanent change to the environment of the bottom of the ocean. Looking at dash ones, I only had one comment that I'd like to see changed, and that's that I believe to be consistent with the laws that relate around undersea cables. That is that we place, if we leave anything on the bottom of the ocean, it should be buried at least 1 meter below the surface. And language in here says
all out.
It can be just all out, or if you leave things the way they've interpreted so far, it's just at the surface. Well, we all know the bottom of the ocean shifts over time. And we've found through working with undersea cables over the years that a meter burial is adequate to not affect the surface of the ocean. So in all fairness, and there's new devices that may be better anchoring systems that can be put into the bottom and then left than taking it out and changing it. So that's the one amendment I have that needs to be added, I believe, is to make it consistent for everybody. It's an even playing field that way. In fact, I'd like to see it carried out into the territorial sea plan with the federal government, that we make sure that anything that's left there that isn't caused by an act of God be at that depth. And at that, I'll stand by and maybe answer a question or two later.
Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Rowland, members of the committee, my name is Jason Bush. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. The mission of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust is to promote the responsible development of ocean energy. That's why we fund environmental studies. That's why we provided funding for the fishing industry to map high-value fishing areas.
this bill is consistent with OWET's intention to promote the responsible development of ocean energy. We worked with the senator's, the chair's office, with Commissioner Thompson and others on this bill to promote the core purpose of this bill, which is to essentially to ensure the timely removal of decommissioned projects, and that's of course good business. We had a couple of issues. Terry, Commissioner Thompson raised one of those, which is to deal with the decommissioning of certain equipment in place. I agree with that proposed amendment to leave anything that's buried as part of the project should probably stay in place, because simply removing the equipment can create more damage potentially than leaving it in place. And if that's the case, then it should probably stay in place. The only other issue, and the Commissioner and I talked about this beforehand, is this timing issue. We still need to work on the language to kind of figure this out. The original language required everything to be taken out within 1 year. I think we all agree that that's simply too fast, and given that the season for getting out on the water could be as low as, say, 4 months out of the year to actually put boats out on the vessels out on the water to do decommissioning, it could easily take more than 1 year, and we just need to address that basic fact.
Thank you very much.
I am Fred Venata, appearing before you on behalf of Oregon Anglers and the Oregon Anglers Research Society. We have a loose affiliation with a lot of sports fishing organizations around the state. Generally, we've had two concerns about the wave energy devices. One of them was the potential effect of the electricity they generate on migrating fish. The other one is the removal of the debris that could be left in the event when the devices wear out. This bill deals with one of those concerns. We strongly urge your affirmative action on the measure.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Okay. I thank you very much, and I appreciate the input, because the reality is we would like to move this bill. I anticipate we will get this bill out of here, but getting it right, or as close to right as we can the first time, and I appreciate all the people who have come to work together to make this happen, because we were thinking about how much money should we charge, and that didn't make a sense, because you never know over time what it really is going to cost, so it's built it in ways that work much better for that, so I appreciate that, and I really agree that the anything buried should be left there, because it is a bigger problem. After I thought about 5 months, if people know the Oregon coast, there's a lot of time you really don't want to be out there trying to do something. It is pretty protective of itself because of the violent nature of it at times. So we have to have enough time to actually do it reasonably. Oh, David Allen is also still here, so we'll call David up. Thank you guys for coming up. David?
Of course.
And is there anyone else that would like to speak to Senate Bill 606? Okay.
Again, thank you, Chair Roblin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Allen. I'm a resident of Newport, and as I previously stated with respect to my testimony on SB 605, I'm a 8-year member of the Ocean Policy Advisory Council. 5 of those years, I was the chair of the Territorial Sea Plan Working Group, which put together what we're referring to as the Part 5 to the Territorial Sea Plan, which deals with a lot of the issues you just heard the prior folks testify to. I agree with everything that Jason and Terry said. All 3 of us have worked together on this for many years, but I just want to briefly put this in context as to the importance of the changes to this statute. ORS 274867 has been in its current form for a few years, and now we're trying to give its more strength and more emphasis and more requirements that I think are necessary. How this relates to the Territorial Sea Plan and the work we've been doing at the planning level is this. The Part 5 document, which was recently adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission. There's an actual section in that Part 5 document with respect to financial assurance requirements that applicants, or I should say developers, are required to meet before they can proceed in developing or siting in the territorial sea, which is 0 to 3 nautical miles out. The importance of this statute in relation to the Territorial Sea Plan, Part 5, is in Part 5, it incorporates by reference this statute and any underlying rules that the Department of State Lands can implement to implement or to carry out the statute. The reason why that incorporation is important is by incorporating this statute in the Territorial Sea Plan, if and when that gets approved at the federal level, meaning the Part 5 document, then not only will that apply to state waters with respect to state agencies, that will apply to federal actions that can be undertaken, not only in state waters, but that might indirectly affect state waters. So this statute, by incorporating it into Part 5 and strengthening it, gives that emphasis as part of the coastal management program that will then provide the state the ability to enforce, through what was referred to as enforceable policies, these financial assurance requirements across the board, whether it's at the state level or federal level. So that's how this statute ties into the Territorial Sea Plan and the importance of that connectivity between the two.
Thank you for that. So just my question. So the issue that Commissioner Thompson was raising about outside, if they put a device outside our Territorial Sea Plan and we have a requirement that they remove it to a meter below the surface, they would probably have to follow that same thing in the federal?
Well, if it's in the OCS or the Outer Continental Shelf, that's going to be primarily under BOEM's jurisdiction. But the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the federal agency, actually, which is kind of an anomaly, has siting jurisdiction in state waters, which is why we undertook this state plan to begin with.
True.
And the state FERC gave the state the ability to create its own plan in state waters because FERC, under the Federal Power Act, has that authority. But the Territorial Sea Plan also applies to federal actions in federal waters if it could indirectly impact state waters. So there's still that connectivity between the two. So, again, incorporating by reference this statute into the Territorial Sea Plan and strengthening the statute will only strengthen Part 5 and the enforceable policies that the state will be able to apply to not only state actions but federal actions as well.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Any questions?
No questions.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else on 606? If not, we are going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 606, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 582. If you remember, we started this bill, we had a big amendment. I didn't want to move it, and I thought we should have a public hearing after people had a chance to look at those bills, and that's where we're at today. So with that, we're going to call in a person, Steve Grassi, who's a commissioner over on the east side. Hi, Sharon. This is Senator Arne Roblin in Salem, trying to get a hold.
Good afternoon, sir.
We're having a hearing here in Salem, and Commissioner Grassley was kind enough to say he'd like to join us. Is he available?
He sure is. One moment.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Judge Grassley. Hello. This is Senator Arne Roblin in Salem, and you are our guest now by phone, and we have just opened our public hearing on Senate Bill 582, and you get to start out with, and have you seen the Dash 1 amendments?
Only a portion of them,
okay.
Senator.
Okay. So we are trying to keep things fairly quiet, so we're going to kind of, if you can keep your comments to around 3 minutes, that would be helpful for us.
I'll move quickly.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I'm Steve Grassley. My address is care of the Harney County Courthouse, 450 North Buena Vista, Burns, Oregon, and I'm the Harney County Judge. And I really appreciate you letting me call in. I'm actually driving over tonight and be over there tomorrow for other business, so save me one trip.
Yep.
Quick history is that Harney County assumed the the building inspection program in the late 90s as a result of the state being unable to adequately provide inspection service in our county. We go 2 and 3 weeks sometimes between an inspector being available. we know that folks fudge because of that fact. I have a strong suspicion that, many permits that should have been bought were not. But at the same time, people needed to get construction work done. And we heard a lot of complaining from our contractors that they really needed the opportunity to, have their work inspected just to protect them of liability. So we assumed the program, hired an independent contractor, and collaborated with Mahier County. It was very successful for a few years, and then our inspection contractor elected to discontinue service here, and has since actually announced he's going to discontinue service in Mahier County. So we find ourselves having to be really creative, and we've got some relationships with Lake and Deschutes County to get the work done. But we're quickly falling behind financially, and we question if we can support this more in a couple of years further, mostly because of the travel cost. So Senate Bill 582 gives us the opportunity to get creative, to work with both cities, or excuse me, both counties, probably several of the cities that are around, and with the state. Each of us have some resources, but none of us have enough resources to provide the complete inspection service. We think 582 is a real opportunity for us to work together. Without this, what's going to happen to us is without a sign-off by an inspector, our power companies actually won't hook up. So even if we got a job done without any inspections because we couldn't get inspectors over here, we're not going to have a structure that's usable when we're done. This really gives us some great flexibility in working together. And I think it's one of those creative opportunities where we need to look at those things that will work in some parts of the state and maybe a challenge to use the same law in other parts of the state. I think this one works for us. I do remain somewhat concerned with, Section 9 of the bill. It seems to me to be fairly broad and is a little troubling to me, but I'm confident that we can find a way to change that, to make it a little more flexible and on a more limited basis than as wide open as it reads to me today. So Chair Roblin and members of the committee, I strongly encourage you to find a way to pass this bill and help not only my county, but certainly my county, to continue to have the same opportunities for economic growth that other areas of the state have. And again, I appreciate you letting me call in, and I would answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much, Steve. Any questions for Steve? And do you want to stay on, or are you going to head off and do your work?
I'm actually watching you on TV.
Oh, okay. It's great.
So I want to make sure you were paying attention. So.
Okay. Sounds good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye. So with that, we're going to call up John Knorr, Leonard Loader, and Eric Peterson. And we're going to try to keep people to 3 minutes, and written testimony is great. I anticipate, after we get all the testimony, that we will be bringing some people together. So if you're interested in working with us, let us know.
Okay. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is John Knorr. I'm a deputy fire chief with the City of Portland, and I am the president of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. The Oregon Fire Service is concerned with the provisions in the Dash 1 amendment. We feel that it limits local jurisdictions to influence critical issues related to fire apparatus access and water supply. In addition, it has the potential to limit rules that the state fire marshal implements that helps us with our fire prevention programs, flammable liquid storage, and other rules of the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office. Local firefighters, regardless of who okays the plans or authorizes these buildings to be in place, will still have to respond to these emergencies when they occur. Access for all types of emergency vehicles is important. Many fire departments provide emergency medical services and ambulance transport, and they front load their responses with fire apparatus to locations. If our access is denied, or not adequate for our fire apparatus to get to a location, we also will have problems providing medical treatment. Water supply needs to ensure that a fire at a location can be suppressed is critical. We need to have the water to put out the fire. We are currently working with DCBS and the Building Codes Division to come to an agreement on some language that will meet the needs of the Oregon Fire Service. I look forward to continuing that relationship and working toward that language. It will also help clear up some issues we have in House Bill 3326, but until we can come to an agreement on that language, I felt it was important that you hear our concerns about the bill.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, Chair, Leonard Lauder from AIA Oregon. Practice architecture here in the city of Salem, and serve as president of AIA Oregon. Our organization actually comes in with both applause and profound concern about the way the amendments have been written in this document. We applaud things like the idea of cross-training and improving access to inspection services and plan review services in the rural parts of the state. However, the way we read the document is designed to be enacted statewide, and so applies in areas like Salem, Portland, that type of thing. Secondly, we see the references to limiting the uses or occupancies to U occupancies. We think that it would be far better to limit the advice provided by the local building official to exempt structures as defined elsewhere in statute, particularly both the statutes governing architecture and engineering licensure in the state. We're a little concerned about, for instance, the fact that the Section 4 makes reference to the fact that activity under this document should not be construed as the practice of architecture in the state, or the practice of engineering in the state, or the practice of landscape architecture in the state. And what concerns us is the fact that it even needs to reference that. The fact that it references and excuses the services provided by building officials on that account seems to suggest that, in fact, those services are actually services that should be governed by the statutes governing architects and engineers for the delivery of services in the state. And we're concerned about that simply because building officials are not accountable to the same degree that licensed professionals in the state are accountable. I think that covers most of the items that I would want to
address. And any written stuff you have would be really helpful. And okay. We'll keep in touch with the people who we need to as we move forward. Thank you.
Chair Roblin and committee, my name is Eric Peterson. I am the president of ACEC Oregon, and I'm also the managing principal of Peterson Structural Engineers. I'm a licensed professional engineer, and also, as the president, represent 110 member firms and 3,500 engineers in the state of Oregon. I come to you before you today in opposition of 582-1 in the way that it's written, and urge you not to vote for this because of the broad nature in which it provides a single entity the ability to modify what is sanctity in our world, the building code. The building code is what sets the standards for how buildings are designed, put together for structural integrity, for egress, for fire suppression, for many other things. And if one entity, the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, has the ability to change, modify, or delete sections of that, it's very concerning for us. I think that the auspices under which Section 2 is written, which says encourage experimentation, innovation, and cost effectiveness in rural Oregon, we are very supportive of bringing that to fruition. And as ACEC, we would be willing to liaise and work with those entities to find a way to make this happen. We do liaise and work with government agencies often. That's part of our charter, and we'd be willing to do that, but we don't see this as an appropriate engine to do so. Regarding back to Section 3, I asked the question, what are the qualifications of the director to make these kind of decisions about a building code? Is the director a licensed professional engineer? Are they an architect? Are they someone who actually can say whether it's appropriate to size a beam one way or another? And if the answer to that question is no, then this is not an appropriate provision. So there are, I have provided for you written testimony, which you have before you. There's also a letter from one of our member firms in Lake County. You, I think, have also received some emails and correspondence from the Professional Engineers Association and members in Coos County who have also shown concern for this. So, again, we offer ourselves up as a resource. Any questions that you may have, I would be happy to try to answer for you today. And I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Question, yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Peterson, was it?
Yes.
My son-in-law is an engineer. I wonder if you could just tell the committee a little bit about the stamp that you have and how that affects your work. My understanding is you're held liable if you stamp a document as an engineer. Is that correct?
That is correct. If I am engaged by an owner or municipality to provide a design, as a licensed professional engineer, when I provide an opinion or a design, I am required to stamp that and say I certify that as a professional, a licensed professional, which has been certified by Ausbeals, that what I'm saying is accurate and within the code provisions. And if I'm wrong about that, I'm liable for it. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Other questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Tracy Rutten, Vicki Woods, and Dan Eisenweiss. And thanks for staying so late. We really appreciate it. We always get to stay. This committee seems to never get over on time. And if it goes a little longer, which it looks like because we have one other panel after this one, if people need to go, they can, but I'll stay around for sure because there's a hope.
And Chair, if I could ask if the City of Gresham has some staff here, I know Dan Eisenbeiss is willing to
That's
go
fine.
After.
Come on back.
Yeah,
come
we
on
can.
Down.
That way they don't have to drive back again.
They can come on down.
Okay. You're welcome.
City of Portland is always gracious like that.
Good afternoon, Chairman Roblin and committee members. I'm Mark Krenz. I'm the assistant building official at the local level at the City of Gresham, and I'm here to represent the OBOA members, Oregon Building Official members, and for the record, we just strongly oppose the passage of SB 582 with the dash one amendments because it causes uncertainty and confusion for municipalities delivering building services. It would make it more difficult for municipalities to enforce the statewide building code and would create delays and added expense for our customers. Additionally, it grants state building codes a level of municipality and oversight that it already possesses. Furthermore, the Building Officials Association would welcome the opportunity to engage in discussion about the expectation of our customers and stakeholders and have with municipalities and building departments and the consequences that would be imposed for failure to deliver efficient and effective services at the municipal level. Senate Bill 582-1, however, is not the appropriate mechanism to resolve these concerns. For these reasons, we cannot support the bill. Thank you for...
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Renton with League of Oregon Cities, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 582, and I will be brief today. While we're supportive of collaborative partnership opportunities when they are deemed appropriate by local jurisdictions, and while we're supportive of flexible tools for rural areas, we are opposed to the proposed Dash 1 amendments as they do preempt local control over current municipal building inspection programs. And in terms of our concerns, we would cite language that is broad, which you've already heard about in Section 2 of the amendments. We'd like to see some clarification on what is considered to be rural or remote in the bill. Section 3 of the bill, again, we'd say that the language seems to be broad in regard to the authorities granted to the director, as it indicates the language is notwithstanding the entire building code's provisions of Chapter 455, as well as Chapters 446 and 460. Our primary concerns are in Section 5. As I mentioned, the language would cause us extreme concern, as the provisions would preempt local control over municipal building inspection programs by indicating that those needing service can now go to the state without having any cause for doing so. This would also allow for the state to collect fees that would have gone to support operations of municipal programs. We estimate that this could decrease revenue for certain jurisdictions significantly. If a city of Corvallis were to have certain major projects opt out for the state, they estimate they could lose upwards of $1.8 million annually and would need to lay off 10 staff. This language gives local programs no certainty in their ability to budget for and operate their existing programs. While the language does indicate that the state shall consult with the municipality, I've been informed that this is no more than a notification that an applicant has already gone to the state. Our concerns are there is no trigger for when someone can go to the state under the language. There is no process, there is no appeal, and there's no opportunity for the municipality to weigh in. There may be instances where the local program makes a decision based on what is best for their community, and they know their communities quite well, and that decision should be considered and may very well be appropriate. And I thank you for your time and welcome any questions you have.
Thank you very much.
Senator Roveland, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me here today. My name is Vicki Harden Woods. I'm the Community Development Director for the City of Salem, and I'm here today representing the city. Part of my job at the city as the Community Development Director is to oversee the building permitting, land use permitting, permitting for the city in general. And while I am not a building official and a technical expert, I am an expert at serving the community and trying to facilitate development in a community. And I have to give you thanks and praise for the work that you're doing in these rural counties. I can't imagine if one of my customers called and wanted to have an inspection and we told them they'd be there 3 weeks from today. That's a problem that needs to be solved. I think in cities like Salem, we recognize that and we're proud of the work that we do. And we want to be able to continue that work in a reliable way. While we support the original Senate Bill 582, we do have concerns with the Dash 1 amendments. I think they've been mentioned to you. I just want to throw my hat in the ring in that and let you know that we'd like to see some further work on this to resolve some of our concerns, and we'd be happy to participate in that.
Thank you. Questions for this group? I do want to say I really feel very strongly that we need to move some things on this bill, in particular the rural areas and maybe some of these others. So we will get in a short time frame as we can. And Senator Betzer has already indicated that he'd be willing to help organize and make sure that that happens. But and maybe it is the definition of rural that would help you. But we know that we have a lot of issues, and you've heard some of them from in a lot of places around our state. And it's very important for us to find solutions that work with that. And I appreciate your willingness to work. I also believe that having some flexibility is really important, too, and so I'll talk to a bunch of these groups as time goes on. But we still would like to make sure that we can move something this session. We have some counties that are in real dire shape of not having any services at all without the state's help. So we have, from the rural perspective, and especially with the lack of funds that some of our communities are having, we're worried that we won't have a building inspecting system. And the contractors that are out there are starting to say, you know, what do we do if we don't have anything? So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Your testimony. Thank you very much. And with that, did you give your place up or do you still want to talk? I'm kidding. Come on up. And we can also have Charlie Taylor. Taylor. And Dan. And Daryl Fuller. I think this is it. That should be. Is there anybody else besides these three that would like to talk that I haven't called? Okay, that's good. Thank you. And this is our final panel.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today. Wanted to speak specifically to the Dash 1 amendment, not to the underlying bill. City of Portland very much appreciates the desire to provide more flexibility to some of the rural communities in the state. But as others have noted, though Section 2 of the bill speaks to rural and remote areas, like House Bill 3326, the following three sections are not limited in application to rural and remote areas. And we do have concerns about how some of those provisions could be applied in the City of Portland. The fire safety provisions give us concern in Section 3. Section 5, as others have noted, does not require a specific kind of problem before an applicant could approach the state to review a project outside of the normal uniform review of building projects by a municipality. That is very much of a concern of ours. Do want to point out for the committee that in current state statute, there are both provisions that allow the state to take over the provision of building inspection programs if a municipality is no longer able to do so or is not doing so according to the standards that are set forth in statute. ORS 455-475 also allows a person who feels aggrieved by a decision by a municipal building inspector to appeal that decision to the state building codes division. So there is also currently a process that allows for appeal of decisions. And then just want to note, in Section 9 of the bill, there is a particular spot I've spoken with the department about this, where we think a technical clarification about the authority of the director could be clarified so that it's subject to the mutual agreements that are set forth in Section 6 of the bill. So with that, we would very much be happy to participate in any discussions moving forward, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you.
Senator Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for your time. I'm Charles Kaler. I'm the manager of the Building Department, LLC. We're an employee-owned, third-party contractor administering and enforcing building codes for 20 jurisdictions in Oregon. Our niche market business serves mostly small, rural cities, but not remote. I think that's one of the differences here about that's being considered. I do see that there's a problem for remote jurisdictions being able to get timely inspections to their folks. I've got to say, because Mark Long and Building Codes Division has been such a support to our work, And under his leadership has really turned BCD into something that is really supportive to what we do. I'd like to support it, but I can't. It's, as was said, they already have in statute the authority to take over counties or jurisdictions that are in default and can no longer operate. The other thing that bothers me is this: I don't believe that the code is unclear, duplicative, inadequate, or unsuitable. Code officials spend thousands and thousands of hours making sure that it doesn't, and in the rare, rare circumstance it does, there all are alternate means and methods to make sure that the spirit of the code is still adhered to and safety is protected. One of the big concerns is that a director's one-off code decision is not appealable, nor are any other decisions regarding agreements subject to review by the Attorney General or the DAS. I trust Mark Long and the director of DCBS, Patrick Allen, but I don't know that I will trust a future one to make those decisions or have that power. Right now, a city can't cherry pick when a big project comes through and says, "Oh, I want the program now," and take it over. And then when that big project is done, you know, just grab it for the money and let it go. So it seems unfair that the state might be able to do that. The other part that was mentioned is that BCD's most important responsibility is the ultimate arbiter of the code. And if they are making code decisions, where do you go to appeal their decision? BCD, under Mr. Long's leadership and Patrick Allen's, has been a partnership with code officials for at least 10 years. But I fear this bill will engender a more contentious and adversarial relationship. And I don't see anything good about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Darrell Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Association of Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors. Due to the hour, I'll be extremely brief. We've been working with Mr. Long on the underlying bill and the amendments. Through the process, we'll continue to be active participants in trying to build something that can move forward and that will resolve as many of the issues as people are bringing forward while still maintaining the core of the bill, which is to make put the state in a position to be helpful when the economy finally picks back up again. And we're hopefully in a position where we've got more projects being built than we have inspectors that are available to inspect. And if we have to draw people from other places to get inspections done so that we can move forward on projects, we want to be able to do that. Excuse me. I will say one thing a little off the top of my head based on the conversation we just had here, and that was the notion that you don't want to be in a position where a contractor could just go to the state instead of go to the city and sort of bypass the normal city process. And it strikes me just a little bit, well, maybe that's not so bad if we introduce a little bit of competition into the inspector process. If we have a position where a city or a local jurisdiction is being slow or dragging its feet, if they know that a contractor could go to the state and get an inspector much quicker, perhaps their feet wouldn't drag quite so often. So I'm not necessarily convinced that that sort of intergovernmental competition wouldn't be a bad thing. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
I guess the only question I have is that, so we have some private contracting that does the building codes for a number of municipalities.
Lincoln City, that, Lincoln County, and Newport are three of the 20.
I'll have to find that out. That's something I didn't know.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill? If not, we will close our public hearing on Senate Bill 582. And the committee, a lot of work today. Thank you very much. As usual, we went a long time. And anybody who has some time tomorrow that they want to spend, we're going to have a little hearing down in room 50, 8:30 tomorrow morning. So, and Senator Przanski and I got to be there, so that'll be good.
And me.
Oh, that's right. And Senator Club. Well, we have three of us on this committee.
Yes, we do.
We're going to adjourn our committee meeting tonight. Thank you. That's.